So let's turn to our Bibles, if you have those. We're going to be looking at Job chapter 8, which in the Church Bibles is on page 515. Last week we looked at the first of Job's comforters, and this week we're looking at number two. And this is him speaking throughout the whole of this chapter. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "How long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. But if you will look to God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. Your beginnings will seem humble, so prosperous will your future be. Ask the former generations and find out what their fathers learned. For we were born only yesterday and know nothing, and our days are but a shadow. Will they not instruct you and tell you? Will they not bring forth words from their understanding? Can papyrus grow tall when there is no marsh? Can reeds thrive without water? While still growing and uncut, they wither more quickly than grass. Such is the destiny of all who forget God. So perishes the hope of the godless. What he trusts in is fragile. What he relies on is a spider's web. He leans on his web, but it gives way. He clings to it, but it does not hold. He is like a well-watered plant in the sunshine, spreading its shoots over the garden. It entwines its roots around a pile of rocks and looks for a place among the stones. But when it is torn from its spot, that place disowns it and says, 'I never saw you.' Surely its life withers away, and from the soil other plants grow. Surely God does not reject a blameless man or strengthen the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouts of joy. Your enemies will be clothed in shame, and the tents of the wicked will be no more."
Let's pray. Father, I pray that you would visit with us right now. And I pray that you would speak. Pray that you would use me as a vessel through which you would communicate what it is you want us as a body, but also as individuals. What is it you want us to learn this morning, Father? You alone understand the complete circumstances surrounding our lives. You alone know all the details. And you alone understand the bigger picture. Father, speak. Speak into our hearts in a way that is relevant to each of us. Father, I pray that our hearts this morning would be ready to hear your voice. That our faith in you, our trust of you, is firm enough that we would say, "Father, speak." For we want to hear, what is it you want of us? So Lord, use this message. Use it for your purposes and for your glory alone. In Jesus' name, amen. And so here we are in another passage of Job. And we learn about Bildad. Now, I guess once upon a time I'd heard some of these jokes because I had a dad who was into corny jokes. But someone came up to me just now and said, Bildad was the shortest man in the Bible because he was Shuhite, right? Bildad the Shuhite. So let's get out all the way before we go any further, okay? Otherwise, I might start coming up with some more. But Bildad, I'm not sure. You know, we said about Job's comforters. I think I referred to them as friends because, at least with Bildad, I'm not sure how much comforting Bildad really did, other than the 7 days where he was silent. You know, that might have spoken wonders to Job. But as you read chapter 8, chapter 18, and chapter 25, and you read what Bildad has to say, and then afterwards you read what Job has to say in the passages that follow, you can see these four guys sitting there, and discussion's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And they get more short with one another. And Bildad comes in, guns a-blazing, shooting from the hip, you would say, and he says, does God pervert justice? Other translations would say, does God fail to do what is right? Does God ever get it wrong? Or does God make mistakes? That's the way he comes into this. He says, how long are your words going to be just a blustering wind? Does God ever get it wrong? Now, our immediate reaction is no, of course. God is perfect, God is holy, God is just, God is right. Don't worry, I'm not about to disprove that. But those are profound questions that I think there are many, even within the church, that still wrestle with. Think about circumstances that you've experienced. And I know there are individuals in this room. I know there are families in this room. I know for myself some of my own wrestlings where we struggle to fully understand, to fully make sense of God in those circumstances. And that's where Job is at. And Job's friend comes in with these statements. Does God ever get it wrong? He doesn't. But that doesn't put away the fact that there are times in our lives where we struggle to really embrace that and accept that. Because we can't make sense of the circumstances that we are in. There was a time for me, 20 years ago, I met my wife. I didn't know she was going to be my wife at that point. I don't think she knew either. But 20 years ago, actually August will be 20 years since we met each other. It was a wonderful time. And it has been. But we got to know each other over a series of months. We were both singles in the same church. We were getting to know each other. And August, then go into the new year. Amir moved up to Kashmir. I was in Islamabad, Pakistan. And then we began to write, got serious. This was before email, this was before we had laptops, before any of that stuff. We took pens and papers, and so we write. Up until she moved away, I hadn't had the courage to actually tell her how I felt, fear of rejection. So I figured I could do it by a letter, and I told her by a letter it was safer that way. And she wrote back, and I danced around the team house I was living in. And we began a relationship. And this relationship was one that I'd been praying for years. That God would help find me someone with a similar calling to mine, with a passion similar to one God had given me. And Amir seemed to be that fit. And then a couple of months later into that, I took a team over to India, to Delhi. And I helped the team get set up. And while I was there, through a number of people, through a number of ways, God spoke to me. And God said, Paul, I want you to leave Pakistan and I want you to come here and live in Delhi. And I knew clearly that's what God was saying. But I realized what that meant. Because by me going to live in India with Amir in Pakistan, we would lose all contact with one another. Because we were not allowed to communicate between those two countries. Those two countries, on and off over years, have not had good relationships. It's not that I could Facebook her or email her or stuff like that. I would have to send a letter. And the way that it worked ultimately is I would send a letter to my mother in England. Mum would shove it in another envelope and post it to Pakistan. There was no direct communication allowed. And I sat there thinking, Lord, I realize this is what you're saying, but it does not make sense to me. And you know what? I was upset. And over a six-month period, I wrestled with God on that one. I accepted his decision and said, God, you know what you say goes. And what happens when I make that decision happens. But I don't understand it, and I don't like it. And I moved, and I wrote Amir a letter telling her this was happening. And over 6 months, actually, we lost all contact with each other. She was writing, but I never got those letters. And it was a wrestle that went on, and it didn't make sense. Well, as you can tell, 20 years later, we are together. We now live in the same country, We still don't need to use Facebook to talk to one another. But God has worked through it. But at that time, in the midst of that circumstances, it did not make sense to me. And that doesn't compare at all to what Job was going through. And I know there are others even here who have faced far more confusing, discouraging, difficult circumstances in their lives. But I kind of look at it, in a sense, like a jigsaw puzzle. Strange, you may say. But in a sense, in that moment, I had all these pieces. I didn't have the picture. I didn't have the picture on the box. But I had all these pieces, and I was trying to fit them together to see, what is this picture? How do I? Because only when I see the picture would it make sense. But it wasn't making sense. And it was even like some of the pieces were missing. And I couldn't. I'd be trying to piece them together. As the picture would begin to form, then I would gain a little more understanding. But I didn't have the perspective in that circumstance that God had. He was the one that not just had that picture, but he was the one that designed the picture of the puzzle that I was trying to put together. Over the years, you're able to add other bits in, and you gain a bit more insight, and the puzzle, the picture becomes a little bit clearer, and you gain understanding, and you begin to see how, we say, the hand of God was in that. And we see it. Even in that experience that we went through, we see how the hand of God was at work in that. We see some of the things that God was doing in our own lives by allowing that circumstance in our relationship at that moment. But other times, you don't get the full picture still, and you are left with some questions. Job didn't have the full picture. And even at the end, Job wasn't given the full picture, even though things were restored to him. He wasn't given the full picture. They didn't have, in their perspective, they didn't have chapters 1 and 2 with them, as we learned about earlier on, a few weeks ago. They didn't have that to help them understand, make sense of where they were at, and what is God doing. So as we continue to explore this story, we come to Bildad. And we see, as I've read in chapter 8, verse 3, where he comes in and says, God never fails to do what's right. God doesn't twist his justice. He seems very traditional, very black and white in his approach. And you would say, insensitive in his approach. And if you read his arguments and his statements in 8, 18, and 25, he does come across as a reasonably insensitive, straight-talking guy. Bildad seems more interested in the problem than the person. He can come across as judgmental. He's very dogmatic about the way, both why Job's situation is what it is and how to fix it. He argues that Job's sons died because they've sinned. Your children must have sinned against God, so he's punished them. I'm sure that went down really well with Job in that moment. It doesn't say that Job punched him, but I just wonder how Job was in that moment. But in Bildad's eyes later, chapter 25 is a short chapter, but he sums it up like this. It says, God is sovereign, man is a maggot. Just they're two very different things. Now, I'm not sure that God looks on us as maggots. I give him credit. I understand a little bit of why he's trying to compare the two, but I don't think God looks at us as maggots. It reminded me more of, we took our kids to see Matilda this week. And in Matilda, the principal, Miss Trunchbull, she has a school motto. Bambinatum est maggitum. Children are maggots, is her motto in her school. And I was reading through Bildad's and thought, well, I wonder whether he went to the school of thinking. But as he goes on, in chapter 8, Bildad goes on to imply that if Job were upright, he would be healthy and wealthy again. It's fairly straightforward in his thinking. And he goes through a series of illustrations of life that says, look, if you do this, you get this. If you do that, you get that. This concept of cause and effect. And he uses a number of illustrations. But this cause and effect concept, it's prevalent in society even today. The core of Buddhism teaching that we live amongst pushes this idea. You find it in Hinduism, this sense of cause and effect. Dare I say it comes into the Christian circles too. If you do your quiet time, you'll have a good day. If you don't, then maybe you won't. These kind of things creep into our thinking. It's not as simple as that. Bildad is insensitive, I think, in his approach and his tone. But I see a part of him in myself, in a number of us. There seems to be this desire, this inherent desire in us to want to fix things, to rationalize things, to make sense of what we can't explain. We don't like not being able to explain things. We don't like the unknown. It scares us. Bildad's trying to fix things. And he comes across in a very rational, he rationalizes things. Problem is, sometimes that helps. Sometimes it does no help at all. And sometimes it just compounds the issue and makes things worse. I remember about 10 years ago when we were planning to leave Dubai to go to Sri Lanka. And we began to discover all of Amir's health issues. And we realized that we couldn't go to Sri Lanka. We were going to have to come back to the West because we needed to go through medical issues and further things. And we wrestled with that. And there was much about that we didn't understand. And as we expected, we had a variety of different opinions expressed to us how to fix things. At least one time, I remember we were given a book. And it had all the answers to our problems in it. The prayers we could pray through to deal with the sins that must have gone on for the reasons that we're where we were. Given by people that were very well-meaning, but figured, this explains your problems. And then it will all be fixed. But by God's grace and through God's power, Amir is in far better condition today. But we didn't go through that book. But we try to rationalize things. We try to make sense of things that are mysteries to us. But it's a mystery because we have a limited perspective. We only see here and now. We can't see what's going up a couple of floors. We can hear what's going on a couple of floors above us. We can't see what's going on up there. But our perspective is always, no matter how knowledgeable you are, no matter how learned you are, our perspective is still limited in comparison to God's perspective. One of my favorite passages comes from Ecclesiastes, where it says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who don't know they do wrong. Don't be quick with your mouth. Don't be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven. You're on earth. Let your words be few, is what it says. It's a very simple but very profound perspective. God sees every dynamic and God understands every context. We talk of him as omniscient. God is all-knowing. It's not just he knows all things. God understands the whole thing. He understands and sees the bigger picture. God alone understood fully the story of Job. We actually have a far better perspective of it because we have the Word of God than those living in that circumstance did, and we still struggle to make sense of some of it. But you imagine how they were in that context when they didn't have any of that. And they didn't have passages that I will refer to later that come up in the New Testament to dwell on. They didn't have the teachings of Jesus available to them, such as we have, or the early Christians, such as we have. It's easy for us to quickly form an opinion of somebody like Bildad, and I already have. I may be being harsh on him, but I've already formed that opinion and expressed it to you. It's easy to do that and consider him harsh and arrogant. But we have to understand the perspective that they were coming from. And Bildad strikes me as somebody who just always wanted to be able to fix things and make sense. He didn't like not being able to. I mean, take the situation where he refers to his kids. In Job chapter 1, it refers to the fact that Job's children used to host large gatherings. They'd have feasts, parties, where there was drinking going on. And Job, it says, every day afterwards, would go and make a sacrifice because it's possible he felt his kids might have sinned. So he sacrificed in case they had sinned. If Bildad's a friend, he knew the kind of life that Job, his kids, lived. It's possible, trying to give him some credit here, it's possible he was speaking into that situation from that context and not just being blatantly harsh. It doesn't say that they did sin, but they did regularly host feasts. It's not justifying in any way that's what happened or makes right what Bildad said, but just trying to make sense of the context of which he's coming from, as opposed to the context of which we're reading it from, because I think they are different. Jesus was once asked a question in John chapter 9. It says, as Jesus was walking along, he saw a man who'd been born blind. So his disciples, they asked him a question. Teacher, who sinned? And whose sin caused him to be blind? Was it his own or his parents? Jesus answered and said, his blindness has nothing to do with his sins or his parents' sins. He's blind so that God's power might be seen at work in him. And then Jesus heals the man. But here again is that same question, his disciples. They see a blind man and said, Jesus, was it because he sinned or was it because his parents sinned that he's blind? Jesus said, it has nothing to do with that. We're trying to make sense from our human perspective, something that we cannot make sense of because we don't have God's perspective. God allows circumstances in and around our lives that the power of God might be displayed. And in some ways, this was going on with Job. Satan had already said, the only reason he worships you is because he's got all of that. Take it all away. If it's just down to you and him alone, I bet he wouldn't worship you. And so God allowed these things. Again, displaying his power that even if you strip things away, man would still worship God. What about us? Will we still worship God if everything was taken away? Or do we worship God because of what we've got? We sing about it. I will worship you until the end. I will worship you until the end for who you are. We sing these songs. But when you really get down to it, when you spend a few sobering minutes thinking about it, would we then stand up again and sing that song? I wonder, in that circumstance, to be in the depth of depression and struggle that Job was in, would he have been able to sing that worship song? Glimpses come out that maybe he would. But there are going to be mysteries in our life. There are going to be aspects. There are aspects of this book that we still struggle to make sense of. There are things that you read about in here and you say, well, how? Why? What? We have those questions. And you can be learned. You can develop your understanding. You can listen to the elders as Bildad said you should do. And that is all good. And I encourage you to. But our insight will only be from that information we get unless God really reveals to us the full extent of the circumstances. Our insight won't be complete. It's okay to not understand. It's okay to not be able to make sense of circumstances and situations. Our view of God, our relationship with Him, should not fall apart because of the things we cannot understand. We're called to live by faith, not by sight. Or Tozer puts it this way in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy. He says, any faith that must be supported by the evidence of the senses is not real faith. Any faith that is supported by the evidence of the senses is not real faith. In some sense, we need those bits we can't make sense of. Those, together with what we do know, in a sense, form, shape, give strength to our faith. Hebrews says it like this: faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of what we don't see, sure of what we know or hope for. The hope we learn of in the New Testament is not a, I hope QPR are going to win this afternoon. Doesn't make any sense whether they do or not. They're still relegated, but I hope they're going to win. That's, you know, that's wishful thinking. And trust me, it's really wishful thinking. But the hope here is an assured knowing. I know absolutely. And there are some things I know. I know God is God. Absolutely, I know God is God. And I am secure in that, and I am comfortable with that. I know there are things I still don't know, though. But I accept those. And they don't cause my faith to waver. They don't dampen my faith or wear it down. I know God is God. But I realize there are still things I wrestle with and struggle with. But I work on those together with God. And that's the relationship of faith we have with Him. We had it when we were, about 5 years ago, when we were heading out to Myanmar, and people challenged us and thought about, what are you doing taking your kids? And maybe some people still challenge us, what are you doing taking your kids? You could sense the excitement on our kids this morning about us going out to Thailand, right? But we know God has opened the door for us to go. And there are some things we know. There are a lot of things we still can't fully explain. But we know that in this journey, as you take those steps forward, what is at the moment in the shadows becomes in the light. And things become clearer. Our walk with God is a journey. It doesn't always make sense. And with Job, so it didn't always make sense. But this book gives us a very real account of a man who is struggling physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. He acknowledges, right after Bildad gives his statement, Job says in chapter 9, indeed, I know that's true. Well, you've just said, I know it's true. But how can we win against God? How can man be righteous before God? How can anyone argue with Him? He can ask 1,000 questions. God could ask 1,000 questions no one could ever answer. No one can stand up against Him. And as you read on through Job's responses, each time after Bildad's comments in the chapters, we get glimpses of a man who understands clearly the greatness of God. He accepts God is sovereign. But his suffering is deep and severe. And you get a sense of a man on the verge of giving up. In fact, in one section, the Message translated as Job saying, God has it in for me. Have we ever felt that way? Do you know anyone who's felt that way? It's understandable why a person may feel that God has it in for them. It's certainly understandable to feel, except why Job feels that way. But we have to remember, we're always looking at it from a human perspective. And even with the best efforts of one another, we're still wrestling at it with a human perspective. God is in heaven. We are on earth. And even in the midst of that depth of depression, Job says, but I know there's someone in heaven who will come at last to my defense. Even after my skin is eaten by disease, While still in his body, I will see God. I will see him with my own eyes, and he will not be a stranger. Fantastic words in the midst of that complete confusion and lack of understanding. That grief, that pain, that anger, the frustration, he still says, but you know what? I know God is God. And I'm holding on to it. It's not much. He says, he refers to it, he says, it's like the skin of my teeth. I'm holding on by the skin of my teeth, he says. Sometimes that's all it is. That's all we've got. But it's enough to hold on to. And I guess the assurance is the fact that actually it's God who's holding on to us. Even in those circumstances when it really doesn't make sense. So let's not get too caught up in what I say the Bildad mode, where we have to try to rationally explain everything. But let's learn that there are mysteries in this walk with God, and that's okay. This walk with God is a journey, and we have to be resolved to pressing on in that journey. It's a journey that takes us deeper and deeper into the discovery and the wonders of God. And it's a journey that goes on until the day when he reveals himself to us in all his glory and we meet him face to face. And then and only then will everything become crystal clear. And all these little jigsaws we've been trying to put together to make sense of the circumstances in our life, one day we'll be able to sit down and look at the pictures on the boxes themselves and it will all make so much sense. So much sense. We're going to play a song. And as the song plays, just quietly sit and allow the song, if it will, to minister to you. It's just a chorus. It's a song that I think many of you know. Just sit quietly and listen. Song that challenges us that we are resolved to press on. Even if we are in darkness, even if we are struggling, even if there are things we cannot make sense of, we are not going to allow those to separate us from God. But rather, we are going to press on in this journey of discovering more about God and his incredible love for us. So let's play this song and let it speak to us.
Bless the Lord, oh my soul. Oh my soul, worship his holy name. Sing like never before. Oh my soul, I worship your holy name. The sun comes up. It's a new day dawning. It's time to sing your song again. Whatever may pass and whatever lies before me, let me be singing when the evening comes. Bless the
Close in prayer. Lord, on those days when our strength is failing, we don't know why or what the future holds, still, O Lord, let us sing your praise unending, 10,000 years and then forevermore. Let us echo those words of Job. I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh, I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I and not another, how my heart yearns within me. Bless the Lord, O our souls.